Welcome back to the program. We hear over and over again that cooperation and teamwork are the keys to 21st century success. Yet we live in a competitive age and are reminded daily that success in the office, on the field, or in the world requires competition and competitive advantage. So how can we better understand and prepare for the competitive environment? Why are some people better at it than others? As Vince Lombardi said, winning may not be everything, but wanting to win is. So what are the biological, physiological, genetic, and social underpinnings of competition? And how can they be approached to create a kind of modern-day survival of the fittest in the arena of success? These are just some of the questions that Poe Bronson takes up in Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe Bronson is the co-author of the New York Times bestseller Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, as well as the New York Times bestseller What Should I Do With My Life? It is my pleasure to welcome Poe Bronson back to this program to talk about Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe Bronson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you here. I want to start with this idea that somehow we think, particularly with respect to kids sometimes, that the stress that comes from competition is something negative. And in fact, one of the things you point out is that stress, particularly a certain amount of it and a certain kind, can be very good for us and good for our performance.
Yeah, we have a widespread idea in our society that stress is bad for you, stress is bad for performance, it's undermining you. We're really worried about kids experiencing stress. Now, let's just make it clear. Long-term stress is bad for anybody. There's all sorts of things it does to your memory, does to your gut, does to your different lobes of your brain. But short-term acute stress opens up the veins in your body. It opens up your lungs. Your heart's pumping. You're coursing. Your body's able to tap into its energy supplies and more oxygen flowing to your body. Your brain shifts. The fear networks get suppressed. And your reward networks get juiced up. Now, to succeed in competition is to take risks that are normally constrained by fear. So you need this sort of mentality, and stress brings it on. Stress is connected to a lot of peak performances. Even if you look at kids, they've done studies where kids taking standardized tests, and they have them just read a line that, don't worry if you're really being anxious today. New science says that anxiety could be helping you score better on this test. They don't teach the kids the underlying physiology of it or anything, but just that alone seems to drive up kids' scores by about 15%. If they can make the connection that being stressed out, not distressed, not freaked out, but amped up and anxious and a little fearful, is going to make you perform better.
And we probably see this best when we look at this professional versus amateur analysis with respect to sports, with respect to performance, and we see that even the professional is stressed, but in a different way.
Professionals view stress as beneficial. Amateurs and novices view it as harmful. You might be surprised to find out that great athletes, dancers, musicians, actors, comedians get very anxious before they have to perform, but it doesn't undermine their performance. They recognize this is their body getting up for it to really bring it. Being slightly underconfident is valuable because it helps you anticipate problems. It helps your body summon the hormonal response you're going to need to be challenged, and it helps you sort of troubleshoot in advance. Walking into a challenge or a competition overconfident is one of the biggest mistakes we can make.
What is the connection? What do we understand between the competitive urge, some of the stresses that come from that, as we've been talking about, and intelligence? How do those two things play together?
Well, it's kind of interesting. There is a gene. It's called the COMT gene. It encodes an enzyme that works in the front of your brain. But it's gotten the nickname the warrior gene, that we are all either warriors or warriors. We're not really all warriors. Half of us have one of each gene, but a quarter of us truly have warrior genes, and a quarter of us have warrior genes. And it's interesting what it does to intelligence, to being able to think clearly under pressure. The warriors actually have a cognitive advantage. They have a 10 IQ point advantage when they're not under stress. On a daily basis, just kind of getting their regular work done, their brains work beautifully. What's going on is that their the dopamine level in the front of their brain is maintained at an optimal rate. But under stress, it flip-flops. Under stress, the dopamine surges. It's like flooding a car engine. It melts down, and they can't think very clearly. Under stress, their performance goes down about 8 to 10%. Meanwhile, the warriors are people who, on a daily basis, it's not that they lack brightness. It's that they don't seem to care enough. They're, like, not getting their work done on time, a little lackadaisical about homework or daily work. They need that deadline in the stress. And what actually happens is the stress rate, they have chronically lowered dopamine levels in their brain until stress comes along and raises it up to optimal. So under a lot of stress, they actually get this cognitive advantage. Their brains work beautifully, perfectly under quite a bit of stress. And we all kind of know this dichotomy. There's people you can count on under pressure, and there's people who are really great but just not under pressure. And it seems to be explained, a lot of it, by this single gene, the COMT gene.
One of the other areas where that plays out, and we see it with performance and public speaking, and even athletes to a certain extent, that the idea of being watched sometimes changes the whole dynamic.
Yeah, you know, if people go back to their childhoods, and I think if, let's say, they played a sport, they played tennis or danced or ice skater. What was it like to, like, have your parent at your meet or at your event? Did you feel better having them there, or were you more self-conscious? Everybody's different. But to a lot of us, to be watched, to have an audience there, seems to undermine our performance, and others, it seems to make us better. So why is it one versus the other? Well, it turns out that when you just learn something, you're still in a learning phase. To be monitored, to be watched, to be judged, makes you self-conscious and undermines performance. But if you've mastered the skills, the extra level of arousal and stress, really, that the audience brings on improves your performance. So if you're a parent and you've got kids out there and they have to go out and really perform, one of the good things to do is actually to show up at their practices so that at their games, it's not the only time they've ever had to perform in front of you. So they get used to it so it doesn't feel so weird, and they don't think, oh, no, I don't want to screw up in front of Dad.
Talk about the risk-reward balance, as you call it, the risk-reward bias that is inherent in the way we approach these things.
You know, Jeff, you're hinting at some of these gender differences that I'll have to admit that Ashley and myself were very reluctant to look at. There's a lot of science of differences in gender, which are very small differences that are often made a lot of hay out of by journalists. But in this case, the gender differences were quite significant. But they're not strictly gender differences. They teach us something no matter who we are. It turns out that whenever you're judging risk and whether to do something, how to analyze that risk, if you focus on the downside, if you focus on the risk, you tend to analyze it very well. If you focus on the rewards, what you're going to get, you tend to be over-optimistic in the face of it. So if you just simply, if you look at buying a lottery ticket, those who think the odds of winning are 1 in 195 million aren't going to buy the ticket. Those who think, I might have $195 million, are the ones who buy the ticket. And in the same way, it turns out that women actually tend to focus a little more on the odds, on the risk, while men tend to focus more on the rewards. The result is that women are better at judging risk. Women analysts on Wall Street are 7.3% more accurate than men. Women politicians, when they enter a race, win more than men. But the downside is, because of those long odds, they often don't enter. So only 4 American women even ran for governor in the last election in 2012. And what this comes back to each individual person is to be aware, regardless of whether you're male or female, to be aware of whether or not risk-taking here is really important. Sometimes that analysis of the odds holds us back from the kind of risks that we actually need to take. And sometimes you're in a situation where mistakes are really going to be punished, and you have to be aware of your own over-optimism.
Does that go to the heart of this idea that for some people it is about winning And for others, it's really about just not losing.
You know, a lot of us would identify, like some people really want to win. Some people, it's not that they don't want to win. They hate losing. And it creates two different playing styles, playing to win and playing not to lose, which actually have very different neurological systems that are involved strategically. Now, playing to win sounds like the sexy one. It sounds like the thing we always want to do. But actually, for a lot of adult work, avoiding mistakes is actually pretty important. And measuring risk accurately is actually pretty important. And but so you have to recognize when, like in our working lives, when are we in a state where we need risk, we need to innovate, we need to come up with new ideas, and when are we in a situation where, you know, we've got to balance the numbers, we don't want to make a financial mistake. We write in the book about nuclear engineers who work for Westinghouse. They certainly can't make mistakes.
What do we understand about the way kids in particular face risk, learn to deal with risk, and how it impacts them later in life, how it impacts the careers they choose and the way they approach risk in their adult and work lives?
One of the most interesting connections is about siblings versus only children, and then within siblings, the birth order of the kids. If you're going to compete out there in the real world, it means going up against people who are bigger and stronger than you. They've been there. They're in a market ahead of you. If you're a kid, you need to go out there on the soccer field, and you're not going to be the best when you first start. Growing up sort of second fiddle is something that younger siblings are used to doing. They're used to standing up to someone who's bigger and stronger who can take what they want. And they get psychologically used to overcoming that compulsion to hide, to quit. And one of the most interesting ramifications of this is in Major League Baseball. In the history of baseball, there's been 350 pairs of brothers, the DiMaggio's, the Alou's. And younger brothers turn out to be more willing to steal bases twice as much as their older brothers. That's a huge gap, 100% increase in the amount of steal attempts and steal successes. They're risk takers. And they've learned to do this from their earliest life. Now, if you've got an only child and you're wondering, what does that mean for me? One of the most interesting things is roughhousing with parents. Roughhousing between siblings is good. It energizes people to get used to this kind of psychology of competing. Siblings fight over, you know, remote control, who sits where in the car, food, parental infection. But roughhousing between siblings gets out of control. The roughhousing with a parent is where a kid learns that fine line between playing and taking it too far. And to be a true competitor, to be a great competitor, you have to be able to go as hard as you can but not cross that line of cheating or doing anything inappropriate. And kids learn this psychology, learn familiar with the circumstance through roughhousing with their parents, where the parents animate them, they tickle them, they throw pillows, they fake wrestle. It gets animated, and right when it's about to get too far, the parents back down. And that's what people learn to be true competitors.
Is that part of this idea that we build up a stress tolerance, that a little bit of exposure to stress over long periods of time builds up our ability to handle it, our tolerance for it?
Absolutely. The stress inoculation model is crucial because a lot of parents think, oh, my kid is kind of stressing out from this competition. School's a little stressful. He just moved from a rec soccer team to a select soccer team, finding it hard. And they wonder whether they ought to be pulling their kids out or just make it kind of shelter their kids a little more. They know they have to compete in the big wide world, but maybe am I going too fast? And what's important is that you want to tax kids without overwhelming them. You want to challenge them without quite threatening them. But you can acclimate them to stress over time because so that they make that crucial switch where the stress becomes power to them, not debilitation. And the worst thing you can do for kids is to deprive them of the games of childhood that give them a feeling for the ebbs and flows of competition. In fact, in our school environment, where people are very worried about middle schoolers and high schoolers experiencing stress, even elementary school kids, you know, a lot of this is over testing and standardized testing. The kind of competition, academic competition in schools that's modeled after like the sports and Boy Scouts and stuff that kids enjoy, are spelling bees, science fairs, other forms of academic competition, debate contests, chess clubs. These are really good for kids, and kids actually need more competition in their lives, even academic competition, but it has to be the right kind. And by right kind, we kind of all know what this means. It means we're, it's not just the final score that ultimately counts. Even if you lose, there can be a lot of other good reasons you did it. You made a lot of friends while doing it. You mastered the sport, mastered the skill, learned a lot of math for the math competition, even if you didn't win. And there need these various factors that are at work in a competition buffer some of the stress and keep them from being overwhelmed. But over time, they become great performers by being continuously, gradually acclimating to competition.
One of the other factors that contributes to that that you talk about is the safety or the comfort of the environment they're doing this in. I mean, it relates to this home field advantage idea, or it could be the same in a classroom.
Yeah, well, home field advantage is not technically an issue of safety. It's an issue of territorialism. It's very interesting. We recognize home field advantage in sports, right? In every sport, the home team wins more, and in some sports more so than others. But when they change stadiums, they have the fans, and they build a new stadium. They've got the fans are all there in the new stadium, even more fans than were there before. It's fancy. It's nice. It should be your home turf. But commonly, sports teams don't have a home field advantage in a new place. And interestingly, not in most of the American sports, but in Europe, because of different racial problems or match-fixing problems, teams have had to play in empty stadiums. They play in their home stadium with no crowd at all, but they still have the home field advantage. And what's going on is a primitive instinct called territorialism, where when we're on our home field, we give it more, we care more. And it's important, you know, when you're having a negotiation to get there first. When people ask for raises on their job, if they ask in their own office rather than in their boss's office, they tend to get a higher raise, a bigger promotion out of it. And so that it's not comfort as much as it's territory to mark even all the way down to a kid's classroom, sort of their turf. This is where they, what they're defending. This is their ego on the line.
Does this come out of evolutionary biology, essentially?
Very much so. I mean, it's not clear the mechanism, although what we do see is that there's a little increase in testosterone on the home field. There's less cortisol involved on home field, a little more oxytocin because people, oxytocin is this thing that we think of it as this sort of love hormone, but it's actually a thing that marks you as friend or foe. And you can spot foes and fight off foes. It's a mama bear instinct. And so through these hormones and home field, evolution has primed us to have this territorial instinct.
What about those quarter of the kids that are facing these competitive situations that are the warriors? How do they move out of that?
Again, it's stress inoculation. When people hear, okay, well, it's really great, you have this cognitive advantage, 10 IQ points, as long as you're not under stress, they think, well, great, but, you know, when you're being judged, when it counts, that's when the stress is there, so what do I do? Out of Stanford, a scholar named Quinn Kennedy has been running studies of pilots, and she's been genotyping them. And what she's found is that amongst novice pilots, to be a warrior, you're way better in a flight simulator than you are for your warrior. But if you've gotten to the next level of training, if you've had more hours in the cockpit, if you've learned to fly at night through instruments, just that extra level of training, that extra hours of experience to the specific stresses that you regularly encounter, trains up and learns, helps you master this stress response. So that warriors actually can outperform the warriors if they, again, acclimate to the specific stresses that recur in their life. They don't have a generalized stress response. If something new and surprising to them, they won't handle it very well. But if it's something that recurs to them, such as in their work or sport that they play, they can absolutely get used to it and be better off overall.
Finally, in an environment where we hear so much, particularly in the workplace and even in education today, about teamwork and cooperation, how does all of this relate to team performance versus individual performance?
You know, the teams can bring out the best in people, especially seem to bring out a lot in female leaders. Women tend to have a tendency to tend and befriend. They befriend their opponents rather than challenge their opponents. And, but on a team environment, if they're already befriending their teammates, they don't have to befriend their opponent, and they work harder for a team. Teams can bring out the best in people. But here's the thing. There's a vogue around teams in the workplace, in schools. Teams are enormously complicated to organize, to say, I've got the 6:15 draft, you've got the 6:17 draft, I'll meet you at this conference room. No, it's that conference room. Did you get this email? Teamwork tends to have a 40% drop in individual productivity. It has to be made up. So what you can do that really matters, the first is teams need to be as small as possible to get the job done. In a team of six, there's 15 connections to keep track of. And commonly in our teams today, we're like, well, let's put a couple more people on that team just to provide more voices, hear from more people. When your team goes from six to eight people, it goes from 15 connections to 28 interpersonal connections. It's a lot more work to coordinate and a big process loss. The other most important thing is about teams is for teams to work, you need to really care. You need to belong to that team and have your identity wrapped up in that team. Unfortunately, 90% of today's workers they're on teams, multiple teams. They're on the marketing team. They're on the product team. They're on the quality team. And the fact that they belong to many teams means they don't have that devotion to a team that energizes them and gets the most out of their performance.
Poe Bronson, the book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. It's just out from 12. Poe, I thank you so much, as always, for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate always talking to you.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.